Blog Talk Radio.
Consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, former police chief, private investigator and instructor at Boston University, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crime Wire team information about an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan and Denny have the night off, although Denny will be joining us in the second segment. This is Tom Shamshak. Our first case tonight takes us to New Hampshire. On the night of February 9th, 2004, Maura Murray, a 21-year-old nursing student at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, vanished after her car went off the road in Haverhill, New Hampshire, along a stretch of Route 112. She was not injured, had apparently been drinking, and had refused medical and police assistance. This, according to a witness, Butch Atwood, who lived on Route 112 and about 200 feet from where Maura had crashed her vehicle. It was he who called police over her objection, and when Haverhill Police Sergeant Cecil Smith arrived on the scene a few minutes later, Maura was gone. Her 1996 black Saturn sedan remained, still holding Mara's personal belongings, some mixed bottled beverages, a boxed wine, and a soda bottle filled with some type of alcoholic drink that was dumped on Route 112. This is a national story that has been updated and published and aired on television stations and newspapers around the country. With us tonight to discuss this mysterious disappearance of Maura Murray is private investigator John Healy, a retired lieutenant with the New Hampshire State Police. John is also the past president of the New Hampshire League of Investigators and past president of the New England Council of Investigator Associations. John has led a team of private investigators seeking to resolve this baffling missing persons case. John, good evening.
Good evening, Thomas. Nice to join you.
Thank you for joining us. Denny, good evening. Vito.
How you doing, Tom? And welcome to our guest. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. John, why don't you start off with a timeline of events before your involvement. Give our listeners some history on the case.
Well, as you already informed the listeners, this happened in 2004, and it received very little publicity in the beginning because it just looked like a normal car accident, and it took a couple of days before people realized much more was going on, and the state and the local police got actively involved. The case was approximately a year old or so when I met with the family down at some training that you put on, in fact, for the Molly Bishop Institute, and I met with one of Maura's aunts. We discussed it in general, and I decided to try and help them. Part of the reason it interested me so much was a close call my own daughter had around that time, and I just felt it was something that, that could not go unsolved or untouched. So using the internet, I put out a call. I wanted to get two or three volunteers, fellow PIs, to see what we could come up with on this case. And literally, I was overwhelmed because I ended up within days with a dozen volunteers. And we began the night we went down to Morazan's house. The fact that you were there, myself and a couple of other investigators, and we began the process of learning from the family what happened. And prior to doing the investigation, before we ventured out on our own, I met with Attorney Jeffrey Strelzin, who's the head of the homicide unit for the New Hampshire Attorney General's office, and I told him what we were doing as volunteers, and suggested if there was anything improper or that outsiders would harm the case, we would certainly back off, and we were welcomed with our efforts were welcomed with open arms.
Okay, can you give us a timeline on Mara's at campus? Mara leaves campus. What happens?
Mara left campus kind of under a cloud. She was under some kind of stress, from what we've learned. And there are a lot of theories going on the internet as to what Mara was doing. Most of them, I believe, are just very inaccurate. But she was experiencing some stressful times personally or academically. We really don't know what. And she left the campus at UMass Amherst and headed up Route 91 in Vermont. We do know that she withdrew some money from an account, and we do know she stopped. I think it was in Massachusetts, but she stopped and bought some wine or something like that. On her way up through Vermont, we know she made two telephone calls looking for lodging, one in Vermont and another in New Hampshire. So it would seem like she probably didn't have her destination nailed down 100%. And the next, time that she was heard from was about 7:25 or 7:28 the night she disappeared in North Haverhill, New Hampshire, just a short distance from the town line of Bath. And this is a very remote area of New Hampshire, very, very remote, rugged area. And in fact, if one went about 300 yards from where her car went off the road, you enter the White Mountain National Forest, and there are no homes or stores or anything for another 10 or 12 miles. So there's a lot of theories on where Mara was going, but nobody really knows for sure. She just traveled up from UMass Amherst, where she was a nursing student, and had some type of a minor accident here in New Hampshire.
All right. And when did searchers begin looking for Mara? Was it that night when her vehicle was there? Because, as I understand it, she crashed. Butch Atwood, who was driving a bus, came by and spoke to her. Well, why don't you pick it up from there?
After Mr. Atwood talked to her, he went to his home, which was about 500 feet away, and parked his school bus. We know that for a fact. Both he and another neighbor called 911, and as you said, Sergeant Cecil Smith came out. For a few minutes, a couple of neighbors saw her walking around the car. Then they all went back to whatever they were doing. And there's only a gap of about 13 or 14 minutes from when the last neighbor saw her till Sergeant Smith arrived. And when he called for assistance from the local fire department, that night they were having of their monthly departmental meeting. The whole fire department just happened to be in the fire station. So they were towed out, and they did the initial searches. And what they were looking for at that time, the roads were clear, but there was a light dusting of fresh snow, you know, covering the rest of the territory. And they searched for quite some distance on foot and in vehicles, looking for footprints going off in the snow, you know, in case she ran away or walked away from the accident. They searched extensively that night, and that would have been within about 30 to 35 minutes of the reported accident. And when it was determined that she was missing, which would have been 24 to 36 hours later, when it was determined that, you know, she hadn't contacted family, the family began searching, and some canine volunteers, and I believe they were from New York State, did a thorough search within about a week, covering a circle with a radius of about 3 miles. You know, it was very extensive very early on.
Okay, and then time passes, and John Healy and members of the New Hampshire League of Investigators get involved. What have you and your team done?
We have done quite a bit over a period of about 5 years. Early on, we just sat down with the family and learned as much as we could. We obtained a lot of verbal information from her dad, Fred, and her aunt, Helena Murray, about you know, what she was all about, where she was going, what was going on in school. They really couldn't give us any details about where she was going or the accident. And so once we had a handle on that, we started to get a baseline on the thing, we just read the local newspaper articles, which gave us the names of the witnesses that the police had interviewed and things like that. And then we began our own investigation. And the first thing we did was send teams of investigators up to the area. As I told you, this is a very remote area where her car went off the road. But within 600 feet of her car in either direction, there were about a half a dozen residences that could have seen the car and that she could have seen. So we began by interviewing those people. A lot of what they told us was repetitive. We did learn something from one neighbor that he did not tell the police, and we didn't learn it for well over a year, but it was something, we don't know if it's significant or not, it just never occurred to him to tell the police, so he was able to relate the information to one of our investigators, which we turned that statement, as well as everything we've done, has been turned over to the Attorney General. We put, you know, information out in the news media. Mr. Atwood moved to Florida maybe 9, 10, 11 months later. We decided to re-interview everybody, and most of the team stayed here in New Hampshire, and we re-interviewed the neighbors. I went down to Florida myself and talked to Mr. Atwood, and again, we gave the Attorney General all of the reports. We kept the family updated. And once we have a handle on the timeline, who saw what did and did not happen when we separated the proverbial wheat from the chaff, we reached out to the wonderful people down at CCSAR, Connecticut Canine Search and Rescue, and set up a massive two-day search in the area, one of three searches that we did.
Okay, and did that yield any evidence?
The initial search was 2 days long. It yielded one piece of carpet from an old abandoned house. We had already had extensive background on the prior occupants of the house, so we were not really concerned we'd find anything. It was quite a distance from where Maura advantage from, but the cockpit was secured and eventually turned over to the New Hampshire State Police down at Troop B in Bedford. Other than that, we came up with nothing probative during that two-day search, and that covered just, it's really hard to say how much land we covered, but we had a half a dozen canine teams and volunteer searchers, covered as much as we could using the locus of the car accident and spread out in all directions. The canine search and rescue dogs were trained. They're trained to locate people or people who've been deceased. They'll locate clothing and things like that. We were just looking for any information, any evidence, that Mara had been somewhere up there, and that during that search we came up. That was the first of three searches, and we didn't really come up with anything concrete. Many, many hundreds of man hours, if not thousands, in were expended in those 2 days.
Now, this has been featured on ABC's 2020 program, as well as on the Disappeared program that airs on the Investigation Discovery Channel. Have any substantive leads been generated from this?
No, none whatsoever that's been brought to our attention. One specific lead that was brought to our attention, we were contacted by a lady who was vacationing in Florida and said she was waited on by Mara in a restaurant. And she was just 100% sure it was Mara. I went to the restaurant in Florida myself, talked to the management, the staff, showed her a picture. Mara, they had never seen her, and they had never had anybody that even remotely resembled Mara working there. So it turned out to be a dead end. And my guess is there probably were lots of other calls, lots of people calling in, which, probably things that we did not hear of, they probably went directly to the New Hampshire State Police. Well, one interesting facet of this case is speaking with Attorney Jeff Strelzin from the AG's office, and this is going back about 5 years ago, when this case was only a year old, the case file in the Attorney General's office took up 5 or 6 three-ring binders, and it's not the small ones. It's the 5-inch thick binders. Attorney Strelzin told me that this particular case at that time, and again, this was several years ago, had more man hours into it for investigative time than any other case, any other homicide, any other case at all that he'd ever heard of in New Hampshire. And that's just, law enforcement, the local county and state police. That didn't include any of our efforts. So there's been an awful lot of investigation into this case.
Right ahead, jump in.
It's amazing listening to this case. I mean, talk about a whodunit with all your background, Tom, and all the former lieutenant's background, John Healy and myself. I mean, somebody just disappearing. And, the yeoman's work that everybody has done on this. I had a list of different questions here, and as John Healy is talking, I'm crossing them all off. I have none left as far as saying, well, Mr. Healy, this, it's amazing. They seem to have done everything on this case, everything. The question I have, John Healy, it says in the report that I have here that the 1996 black Saturn sedan remained still holding Mora's personal belongings. Now, do you mean her cell phone was in there too, sir?
No, her cell phone was never found. We know that the cell phone was used by her, but within the hours prior to the accident. Her cell phone was never found. There is no cell phone service in that area. There was some clothing in the car, some light clothing. I think it was either a box or a bottle of red wine that had spilled. He's believed to have left with some type of a small backpack with personal belongings in it, and that was not there. That was gone.
And this stretch on Route 112, 101-112, where she crashed her vehicle. I guess it says here she went off the road. Was there a lot of, I think you mentioned snow before, was there a lot of snow on the ground at that time, sir?
No, there wasn't. The road itself had no snow, but off into the woods, there was snow on the ground, but not a tremendous amount. It was February 9th. It was an extremely cold day and cold weather, and had been, but there hadn't been a tremendous snowfall up to that point in time.
And no tracks, no visible tracks the next day when you guys went there, of any footprints of anything leading away from there, since it was down in a ditch, I would imagine, right? I mean, did you spot, was there any prints at all, sir?
No, there were none. The initial search was actually done approximately 30 minutes after the accident when the Haverhill Fire Department came, and the whole department was at a meeting that night, so they all showed up. And they did an extensive search. They branched out, you know, left, right, up, down, north, south, looking for footprints. They did it on foot and in vehicles. And, you know, they were looking for something where a person might have walked several hundred yards and, you know, walked off or tried to hide or something. And they did it very thoroughly. There were quite a few people there along with the police. And no footprints were found. More volunteers, and this is before I got involved, but more volunteers and canine volunteers and family members were up there within a couple of days. And likewise, nobody ever came up with a footprint.
And this Butch Atwood, I'm sure you determined if he had known her in the past at all, right?
Correct. There was no relationship. Butch Atwood lived about 500 feet away. He was driving a school bus that night. That was his occupation. Mara had no connection with any of those people. We are relatively sure that Mara was headed across the state of New Hampshire up to Bartlett, which is near North Conway. That was a favorite place for her and her family. They had stayed up there, and where everything points that that's probably where she was headed.
Well, before I give it back to Tom and possibly Denny, too, one last question. What kind of an area was this stretch of Route 112? What type of area are you talking about there? Is it
okay.
Wooded, any wooded areas? Is it what?
It's very rural. It's rural residential. It's a two-lane rural highway. The speed limit at where she went off the road was, I believe it was 30 miles an hour. And she went off the road right where there is a 90-degree curve in a road. It curves to the left. And somewhere, I would guess, probably at the apex of that turn, something caused her to lose control of the vehicle. She did a 180 and just came to rest facing the wrong way, but the car just bounced off a snowbank. It suffered almost no damage from that accident. It was more that it just, you know, she just lost control somehow and slid off the road.
Well, Tom, this is the type of case where, just because of everything that's been covered already on it, this is the type of case for me where, since I'm a night owl anyway, this is the type of case, if I'm working on this for several years, I'm walking around my home late at night when my wife and everybody is sleeping, just saying, okay, what the heck is going on here? And just pacing and trying to figure it out. Right, Tom? This is a real whodunit here.
It is. It is. Let me just ask John to share this with us. A state police dog was brought to the scene, about 39, 40 hours later, and did a little tracking?
Correct. When it was determined this was more than a drunk running away from a car, you know, which is pretty common in law enforcement, they asked the state police to send a canine unit up. They sent the dog off of an article of Morris clothing or something taken from the car. The dog began its track at right at the scene of the accident, and the dog continued down Route 112 easterly for a distance of just under 600 feet, and then he stopped. And that would have put him right at the intersection of a road called Bradley Hill. and the scent was lost. And in discussing it further with the Connecticut canine search and rescue people, that's pretty common. Cold winter days like that, the scent particles, whatever, you know, the dog was following, lay mostly on the surface, and any kind of wind may have blown them away. So the dog went 500 feet and just stopped by that intersection. It turned out it didn't give us anything probative other than it, if one believes the dog, and I do, I used to be the commander of the training unit for the state police, and I know how well those dogs are trained, that the dog just got to the point where, you know, the scent disappeared and he had to quit. But if nothing else, it told us the direction she chose to walk in, and that's, it's little, but it's important.
It's an interesting case, isn't it?
That's not the word for it. It's baffling. It's perplexing. The people that have been on the team, which includes yourself, a retired police chief. There's another New Hampshire police chief that's retired. Detective commander retired from Rutland, Vermont. Former Army CID investigator. Literally a brain trust of people. We've come up with a lot of good theories. We've developed some information that we really have not told the public about, and we can't, and that's been given to the Attorney General. But each and every one of us, you put it together, there's about 300 years worth of experience, and we've all reached the same conclusion. This is one of the strangest things that we've, stranger than even things we came across when we were all active cops.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Listen, John, thank you for coming on as a guest tonight. Please keep us updated on any progress. And I'm sure you've got a couple of other interesting cases. John Healy's also an author. Maybe we could get him to come back on and chat with us again.
I would love to do that anytime, Tom. Thank you.
All right. All right. And before we go, John, the name of your company is Litigation.
Yep.
Go ahead.
You're the host.
Litigation Intelligence Services.
That
can be found
correct
on the internet at litigationintelligence.com. John specializes. He's done a lot of training with law enforcement and PIs. He does a lot of statement content analysis training. He's well regarded locally, and maybe you'll get some calls from litigators from across the country.
Well, I hope so. And as my team moves on, we will keep you and the station informed of any new developments. We need to keep the public's eye on this case.
All right. John Healy, thank you so much. And
good night, Tom.
I'll turn it over to Vito.
Okay.
Good night, Vito.
Good night, sir. Tom, this is really, that case that we just talked about screams major tip needs to come in on, I guess you just sit and you keep doing your investigation, but you wait for that big tip that actually comes in that kind of puts you on the roll, right, Tom?
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's amazing. Listen, before I introduce my our next case that we're doing, just one announcement I wanted to tell the listeners. If the show that I'm involved in on the A&E network, it's called Bloodwork. It's been a big success. I've done 13 episodes of that. Check your listings. It's on A&E Crime and Investigation Network, and they've really done an amazing show. I'm on that, like I said, for 13 episodes of the 19 that have been on. And so just check it out. It's on all different times. It's repeated several times during the week. And that's about it on that point. Now,
do you have before you get to that, is there a fan page where there's information about that?
Yeah, what they can do is you go on A&E, on Google, go into Google, hit A&E. Now you'll see different stations for A&E, okay? And what you do is you look for, it's called CNI, Crime and Investigation Network. So you'll see A&E, CNI. Because they'll have all kinds of products to buy for other shows and different things like that. And then you'll see a lineup of the shows, and you'll see Bloodwork on there. And then you just got to check your local listings and see when it's on. You know, here in the Northeast, it comes on a Friday night, and then it's repeated several times during the week till the new episode comes on. But it's a fascinating show. Dr. Archer is on that, Dr. Larry Kobolinski, Susan Filan, the head legal analyst for MSNBC. So it's a lot of good regular people, regular guests on there each week. So, you know, check it out. I think you'll like it. It's a fascinating show. It's about all cases that were solved forensically. And it's, you know, glad to be a part of that. But this case here, this is a sad, sad case. And no matter how many years that Tom Shanshak's involved in police work and everything else, and no matter how many years Vito Colucci is police and private detective, you still get these cases that just breaks your heart. This case has been a daily, it's been on the paper, New York Post, New York Daily News, New York Times. It's been on a daily basis for the last several weeks. I'll read a little bit of the description to everybody. Earlier this month, an 8-year-old Brooklyn, New York boy, Libby Kletsky, got lost while he was walking home alone from day camp in his Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. The child approached a stranger for directions. After the child was reported missing by his parents, the child and the male stranger were observed on some video surveillance footage. The child's remains were discovered not too long after that, stuffed in a trash bin in the man's refrigerator. What went wrong? How could such an atrocity occur in one of the safest sections of the city of New York? More importantly, what can be done to prevent such a depraved act from happening again to such a vulnerable victim? Now, let me state again before we open this up for comments and everything. You're dealing with a little boy, 8 years old. This is the first day he's allowed to walk home from day camp. I know this case pretty good. I've talked about it now on TV and other radio shows. He spots a guy that looks a little bit familiar to him from the Jewish community. Okay, so he's totally lost, this little 8-year-old, innocent little kid. He asked this guy for directions. And the bottom line, without getting too graphic about it, several hours later, one part of his body is found here, another part is found someplace else. And really a sick individual by the name of Levi Aaron, who was the killer. Great work by the New York Police Department in checking the videotape, like they say, and getting this guy right away. He had tried the information. Now, every day it's a new front page story on this. He had tried, the headlines I got in front of me from a week ago, it says he tried to pick up my son too. And what happened was the mother started to scream when she saw this guy approaching her son, and he ran away. Now, this opens up a lot of questions. Why didn't that mother notify the police about this guy? What we have found out from different people that have talked on TV shows and other is that in the Jewish community, and this is something I didn't know, in this Orthodox Jewish community, where in New York City, you know, you have the different sections, Tom. You have, you know, Chinatown, you have Little Italy, you have section. Well, there's a whole big section where the Jewish Orthodox people live. And what happens is that they kind of monitor their own self. They have certain leaders of that community. They have certain people that watch out for everybody. They try to handle things all themselves. Now, here's the line to throw out. Here's the most tragic line that I have heard on this, and see what our blog people put out there. They had said to the police, several people in this community, Tom, have said to the police afterwards, we were watching this guy because we knew all about him, and we had our eyes on him. Now, what I screamed on a television show is, well, it didn't work. It didn't work. You had your eyes on him. He wound up murdering somebody. You can't watch this guy. You call the police. You say, this guy tried to pick up this kid last week. We're in fear for our community. And maybe this new case, Tom, would not have happened. What's your theory, or what do you think about this? This is all over the country, so everybody knows about this case now.
Yeah, I was astonished when I heard that the mother of this other child had failed to bring it to the attention of either the police or the Hasidic community's patrol that is out there in the neighborhood. If they were aware of this guy, it's mind-boggling that he was allowed to escape after that first incident. And again, you go back a little further in this guy's history, he has only one minor brush, and they have it as urinating in public. But you and I, as former law enforcement, we know that is really, it's a lesser included in the charge of lewd and lascivious behavior. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, without a doubt, Tom. And there was a lot of things about this guy in the past. He moved to Tennessee, okay? And as they talk now, of course, after the fact, where a poor little boy is dead, they talked to many, many people in Tennessee that knew him. See, this fella worked at a kosher deli where he worked as a butcher, okay? And the people they talked to, they said just his creepy stare alone freaked them out, whether he was looking at the children or whatever else. And then on Facebook, people told the police that he wrote on Facebook that he likes Brooklyn more than Tennessee because there are more boys there. Now, you know, this screams out injustice here. Now, of course, Tom, you know, and you're a former police chief, you know somebody has to actually break the law. He said can't be arrested for standing in a spot staring at a mother and a little boy, different things of that nature. You can't even basically get arrested for saying I like Brooklyn better than Tennessee because there's more boys there. Obviously, if I'm a cop, the very least I do is go over with my partner and question him is, what does that exactly mean, Levi? Something of that nature to let him know we're on to him. But, there were so many signals that were done on this case, Tom, and it's a shame, and I get upset about it. I got on in the late 1960s, and I'm still doing this stuff. And, you know, having five kids and grandchildren now, it's just like there's a little kid that just says, oh, wait a minute, I recognize that guy from my street. Let me go ask him. You know, I mean, what a horrible story. This has gained so much attention, which I'm glad, because maybe it'll make the public – you can't monitor yourself. You can't police your own community. You know, Tom, across the country, and then I'll shoot it back to you, where you see on a lot of streets neighborhood watch signs, okay?
Yeah, crime watch.
Which are good. They're very good. Right. Neighborhood watch, that means there's people, a group of people on that street that's monitoring that suspicious car. They write it down, green Ford Taurus. They put the plate down. They report it to the police. But you see, those things are only good if you're reporting them to the authorities, okay? So that's the whole key with this thing. And none of that was done on here. They, like you said before, you gave the description, the Hasidic community monitors their own, and they don't want anybody else involved in it. Well, it really backfired, Tom Shamshak, this time.
It did. Like Denny Griffin, what's your perspective?
Yeah, it's a very frustrating case. As Vito just pointed out, there are a lot of signs here, and for this guy to still be, you know, out there and loose because perhaps that community thought they could self-police or whatever, you know, if that was one of the problems. But, you know, last week we talked about the disappearance of the Missouri woman, Jackie Waller, and one of the things that came out during that show, we were talking about women who are in some of these abusive situations, on many occasions think they can handle it themselves. They're not going to involve the authorities in some cases. They don't want to tell their family because they're big girls and they got themselves into an abusive situation. They'll get themselves out of it, and they can outwit or handle their abuser. And then when they disappear or end up dead, it's too late then to say, geez, maybe they could have done something different. But it's almost similar here, where we were talking, these women think, okay, we can handle it ourselves. We'll deal with it. And they really can't, and they should have brought someone else in or got extra help. Here we have a situation with the community thinking we can handle this ourselves. We'll leave the cops out of it, and we'll do our thing with it. And as Vito said, it backfired big time, and that's just I don't really know what to say. I get so angry when I think about this, And we hear about it all too much, not only with this case, but similar cases. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that goes down, the bad things that go down, don't really have to happen. Some of them are almost not preventable. I mean, it's just the way things work out. But in cases when there are clear indications that you have a problem in your community, and the advance warning, it just doesn't seem as though it should end up with a kid like this dead.
No, no.
Yeah.
And sadly, the parents had taken him on a dry run a day or two before he went missing, and it was his first day walking home alone, which goes to the point that you really can't, just can't allow your kids out there alone.
Yeah.
They just not.
It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing, Tom. And you know, his ex-wife now has spoken out about this, okay? And she has said the following. She has called her ex-husband, Levi Aaron, a cold psychopath who's all too fit to stand trial, okay? Now, meanwhile, you know, he's scooped up a good lawyer, and he's right now, I think as we speak, probably still in Bellevue Hospital prison ward undergoing a court-mandated psychiatric evaluation, okay? You know, sometimes it's hard to figure out. I mean, you know, the description of what he did, okay? Just to say it quickly, they said Aaron cut off the boy's entire legs so the body would better fit in a small suitcase. Then he severed the feet from the legs and placed them in the freezer as a sick souvenir. So, you know, a lawyer representing him would probably have a good shot of saying no man, no person in their right mind would do something this evil. You know, what do you think, Tom?
I agree. You know, there's a possibility that, you know, this is insanity. Whether or not, you know, they'll be able to prove it, I think they're going to have him go through a psychiatric evaluation to see if he's, you know, fit to stand trial, if he's competent. But, you know, in a couple minutes here, if we could just talk about, you know, crime prevention measures. Parents really need to, again, you know, law enforcement is out there, but too often law enforcement, perhaps just as is true of the community patrol, they're reactive. And you can't, you know, rely on a patrol, whether it's a police car. Parents have to assume greater responsibility for the whereabouts of their children. And if it means, you know, hiring somebody or, you know, getting the child hooked up with, you know, another child that where there's an adult present, that's the, I think, the most reasonable and prudent route to take in the future.
And, Tom, let me just mention something there. They not only have to do what you said and be aware of what's going on, but a couple of years ago I was doing some shows about the pedophiles, and I talked to some national experts, and they said one of the things you got to be very careful of is these perverts that these are not stranger abductions, but what they do is they will befriend the family so that they're welcome at the house. You know, young adults, maybe in their teens, high teens, early 20s, and so forth, and you know, they'll come over and help if they see a say a project of building a room on the house or doing some roofing or that, and mowing the lawn, whatever. And pretty soon they worm their way in and gain the confidence of the especially if it's a single parent situation, and all of a sudden you get to like this person, have them over for dinner a couple of times, then you want to go out and take in a movie or whatever, and oh well, you know, I can watch a little Johnny for you while you're gone. And pretty soon you get a molestation situation going on. So it's not only the enemy without, but the enemy within. You got to make damn sure that that people who suddenly want to start hanging around your house and so forth, of where they're coming from and what their background is. I mean, you got to be alert to all phases of this.
But not only that, Denny, isn't it a sorry state that we have nowadays that if you're in that situation, It could be your best friend who says those words to you. Oh, go ahead. Why don't you guys go to a movie? I'll stay. It could be your brother-in-law. It could be your first cousin. It could be anybody nowadays. I mean, you know, the more and more of these things happen, people aren't going to trust their own sister, their own brother. You know, you're always going to have a little doubt in your mind. Am I right, Denny, or what?
No, you're absolutely right. Let me tell you, I get so annoyed with hearing these stories over and you know, we only scratch the surface. Who knows how much of this stuff goes on that never makes the papers or at least the national headlines or anything. But right then, I'm currently in Verona, New York. That's right about in the middle of the state. And a little community, it's a small city called Sherrill, which is about 2 miles from me. A couple of weeks ago, a live-in boyfriend stabbed to death a 6-year-old little girl. Got a cute little girl. And apparently, we still don't know for sure what happened. But anyway, this guy went to arraignment today, and I don't know what his defense is going to be. But he went to arraignment, and there was a big splash in the local paper tonight that the authorities are very concerned about him. He seems to be despondent, and they're going to have a 24-hour suicide watch on him. And you know what? And this may sound cruel, and I might get a lot of hate comments over this. Let him. I wouldn't watch the son of a bitch. I'd put a rope in with him and say, see you later, and hope like hell he hangs himself. Now, I'm saying that obviously a correctional facility can't do that. But my personal feeling is I wouldn't – this guy, there's no question he did it. He was caught, you know, in the bedroom with the girl, knife in hand. I mean, there's no question here about innocence. And if he's feeling despondent, too frappin' bad. I don't care if he walks out of that jail alive or is taken out in the back of the coroner's wagon. That's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, it's such a tough situation, too, Denny, because, you know, here you're looking at a guy, and I'm reading different reports about him, this Levi Aaron guy. He had been diagnosed many times over the years with a severe behavior disorder, and he's on heavy medication for this condition. My question is, or I think the biggest dilemma we have as a country is, okay, then, what do you do with a guy like this, okay? I mean, he is extremely sick in the head. But on the other hand, too, do we let him roam outside where he can kill your grandmother or do what he did to this little 8-year-old? I mean, we have so many people, Tom, across the country that are like this. And you know yourself, when your patrolman would ask you, what do I do with this guy, Chief? I mean, he didn't break any laws, but look, he's something's going to go off with this guy. I mean, right or wrong, I saw many years on the police department calling the street sergeant or the lieutenant over and say, hey, what do we do with this guy here? Well, nothing, Vito. He didn't break any laws. Unless we get him as a vagrant or if he does breach of peace or disorderly conduct, we can use an excuse. I mean, what do you do, Tom, in a situation like that? Get these people off the street.
Well, you know, let's go right back to the whole, you know, deinstitutionalization philosophy that it was a, you know, kinder and gentler nation that would remove people that were predatory or potentially obnoxious, out there on the street, and they would be ushered away, warehoused, and then what we do? This goes back to the President Kennedy administration when they began to deinstitutionalize, and now you're absolutely right. You go to any urban environment, and you're going to find clusters of these individuals that are walking around that are not taking their medicines, and they're causing, if not criminal activity, certainly quality of life detriments to a community. Would you agree?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, this goes back so many years. It's such a big dilemma, and our country is getting worse and worse with these things. When you go back to the Casey Anthony thing, as I looked up certain statistics for some of the big TV shows, you know, there's been 51,000 missing persons, children under 17, murders, I should say, over the last several years, which about 20-something% of them have not been solved. And, you know, it just all this stuff just screams out. You know, we talked about that last case. Where is that woman? You know, if something, if she was right in her mind or whatever, I'm not going through a lot, too much in her life. I'm sure she would have presented herself someplace. Somebody maybe have grabbed this woman and never to be seen again. So, I mean, it just goes on and on, you know?
Yeah.
You can't even
the crazies.
Parents can't even have their kid now, nowadays, on their front yard. Not so many feet even away from the front door. They're constantly looking out the window because people, sometimes the listeners don't know, unless they're, you know, do this stuff like, you know, Dean Beers and his wife does, you and me and Denny, of course, in the past and everything else, how, realize how quickly these abductions take place, okay? We're talking a matter of seconds, not 2-3 minutes to do this, a matter of seconds to grab a child, throw them in the back seat, and you're gone, okay? So if you're a mother that's maybe in the backyard down the end of the driveway and your daughter's way near the street for some reason walking around your little toddler, people come, that kid's in the car, and that mother can't catch up to that car. So it's just amazing. People are afraid to let their kids do anything nowadays.
And Vito...
Go ahead, Vito. Go ahead, Denny.
Excuse me, Tom, but I was just going to say that in addition to these potential for these 6 and 8 and 10-year-olds to get snapped up either by a stranger or some pervert who gets in tight with the family, you know, and concealing his motives until it's too late. You get the 13 and 14 and 15-year-olds with the computers and going online, and you know these predators that latch onto them at that age when they're getting the you know, ready to leave the nest thing, thinking they're adults. And they got to watch that, too, because here isn't where they're necessarily, at that point, forcibly taken or whatever, but they think they want to have a fling. They're adults. They can handle their own affairs at 13 or 14, and they get suckered in thinking they're dealing with another kid their own age on the Internet, and it's actually some 30 or 40 or 50-year-old pervert, you know, looking to get them to run away with them. So, I mean, the dangers are all over the place. It's really scary.
It is. It is a growing problem. A growing problem.
And Tom, what a lot of these people are doing, too, is they'll monitor Facebook, they'll monitor different sites, and they see little Mary talking to Joni and saying, okay, I'll meet you at the mall at 1 o'clock. We're talking to maybe 12-year-old kids or something like that. So, you know, they're dropped off by the parents to meet, maybe just to have a safe time in the mall shopping and having a hamburger or whatever it is. But the guy who just monitored all of that on Facebook shows up. He sees their picture on Facebook, so he knows who he's looking for. And he walks up to little Mary and says, hey, Mary, I'm Joni's you know, if it's people that don't know each other's family, I'm Joni's dad. I have her in the car out here. Can you come out and get her? I don't want her to walk by herself in the mall or anything crazy like that. It sounds far fetched, but these people stay up all night long thinking of these scenarios, Denny.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're hunters. I mean, predators, and they put a little time in. They put the time in to learn and know the best way to get their victim, to get their prey, and they go for it. And it's like I say, it's just, you know, it's frustrating, it's scary, and as Tom mentioned, it seems to be getting worse, and that makes it scarier yet.
And think of the parents, Tom and Denny, think of the parents of Levi Kletchke, who they are basically in a pretty safe area. The camp is right up the road. What do we have to fear? It's the whole Jewish community here we live. Okay, you've been asking us every day. Walk home today. Go ahead, kid. We just make sure to stay on the street, blah, blah, blah. How do you think they feel now, blaming themselves, which they should, okay? They would do what sometimes many other parents would do. If you feel you get accustomed to a real safe area and everything's going to be okay. I mean, the guilt that they're feeling now is so horrible, Tom, you know?
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. I wonder what will happen going forward with their strategy of monitoring behavior in that community? Will their, you know, their citizens patrol be, you know, taking some guidance from local law enforcement, from NYPD? What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, if I'm the commander of a division that covers that area, Tom, first thing I'm doing is I'm setting up a meeting in that area. I want as many of the Orthodox Jewish people as possible. I want to do it in a big school or someplace like that. And just, you know, just say, look, we realize what you people have been trying to do over the years, monitor yourself and all this kind of stuff. You've seen the tragedy that happens. We are going to stop that now. We want to be called. We don't care if you're bothering us 10 times a day with different plate numbers or different suspicious people. That's what we want from now on. I mean, that's the first thing I would try to do as a commander of a division or the police chief or the mayor of New York that kind of goes to everybody and says, hey, set up these meetings and stop this from happening again. So.
Well,
you know, we have a neighborhood watch, which I guess is maybe somewhat similar to what was happening there. In our neighborhood watch here, and of course I'm not here year-round, but I have been to a couple of the meetings, and they work, the neighborhood watch works hand-in-hand with the police. Both the county sheriff's department and the state police, which are the two agencies of jurisdiction here. There's no village police department. So, and in fact, at their meetings, a couple of times a year, they'll have representatives from the police agencies come in and attend the meetings and talk about this and that, you know, different things to watch out for, different scams, different whatever. And I've never heard at the meetings I've been at or when I've talked, not at meetings, but talked to people who are in the neighborhood watch, I've never heard anybody say, look, if you see a suspicious vehicle or whatever or a suspicious person, let us know here at Neighborhood Watch, but we ain't going to tell the cops. I mean, that's just not the way it's done. If you see something out of the way or something oddball or an oddball person or an event or something that just doesn't look right, you make a note of it, get whatever information you can, a license plate number, description, what have you, and you call the police and say, here's what we got. And in fact, the police don't discourage that. I mean, I know they get a lot of stuff called in that doesn't really go anywhere. It's an innocent situation, somebody overreacted or whatever, but they've never discouraged calling in. They'd rather have you, the old safe than sorry thing, they'd rather have you call in with something that you think is out of place than not call it in and have something bad happen. So, you know, I mean, you can have, I think, your neighborhood watch type organization or whatever, but I don't see how you can do it and just totally exclude law enforcement from it.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I'm an ex-cop. I carry a gun still every day, but I would not take action myself. I'd be calling the police. I would try, obviously, to get the plate number of the vehicle. I would try to do anything in my background experience to try to get as much information. But then I'm on the horn with the police, giving it to them. I'm not going to go try to do something on my own unless a crime was in progress. But, I mean, that's the way it has to be done. Now, Tom, I'm sure, you know, with your time as a police chief, I'm sure you instructed. I'm sure you've had many meetings with the general public as to, you know, here's what we should do. Here's what we're going to set up. Here's what we're going to have, you know, street officers again walking the beat or whatever it is. I'm sure you had many of those meetings, you know.
I did, and let me say, when I was chief in Winthrop, Massachusetts in 1997, we ranked seventh in the country for towns with a population under 20,000, and in 1998, we ranked fourth in the country for the quality of our crime prevention initiatives, and that's through the National Association of Town Watch. And a crime watch, rather. And, you know, I'm a strong proponent of that. And, you know, that partnerships between the police and the community is essential. And I hope that this, you know, young child's death strengthens the relationship between the community and the police department. And
well,
with that, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Tom. I was just closing over here. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to just give it right back to you.
Okay. On behalf of the entire CrimeWire team, we want to thank our listeners across the country and look forward to your input and commentary in connection with future cases that come to CrimeWire. Thanks also to the CrimeWire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at Imagine Publicity. Our next show will be Tuesday, August the 2nd. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Sean Shanchak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.